We have the subcommittee first or full committee?
No, it's just.
Committee on Rules to order. The quorum is present. It's Tuesday, April 14th. Senator Anderson is here to present a bill that he's co-authoring with Senator Reinert, who couldn't make it today. Senator Anderson, welcome to the Rules Committee and Senate File 1828.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, Senate File 1828 is before you. The House file in the other body is House File 1942. And what this bill does is and I'm presenting this on behalf, as you mentioned, Mr. Chairman, on behalf of Senator Reinert, who could not be available today. But this resolution memorializes Congress and the President of the United States to provide funding for and to maintain and restore the Officers Club building located on the grounds of Fort Snelling and to support services provided at the Officers Club. Fort Snelling is a national historic landmark, and the Officers Club provides a venue for military officers, military families, and civilians to socialize and find fellowship. And just in the last 3 years, it has been opened up to the non-commissioned officers, which is the enlisted group. So now, basically, military officers and enlisted people are welcome there, and it's been a venue there for Fort Snelling. Having served at Fort Snelling for 26 years, both in the Air National Guard and the Air Force Reserve, and the Air Force Reserve is the one that is charged with overseeing the management of the Fort Snelling, Officers Club. And so we're just asking that we go forward with a resolution to ask the federal government to take care of the facility there and to provide funding to make it so that it doesn't have to be done away with. Right now, we're in a situation where, because of the heightened crisis that's in the world today, because of terrorists, they found that in doing analysis that there's possibility that these bases could be under scrutiny and be attacked. And so they've been, the federal government has been asking these bases to take precautions in coming forward with security measures. But the cost of the security measures for doing this, because of the highway separating the Officers Club from the main base, puts it in a precarious situation. And so there's no money in here asking from the state, but it's just asking the federal government to come forward, asking our congressmen and our U.S. senators to consider coming up with a way to keep this a part of the Fort Snelling historic area and to make it so that we continue our tradition from way back in 1862. 1820s, I guess it goes back farther than that. And there are some pictures in the packet there showing the inside of the historic Fort Snelling Officers Club. And one picture shows the actual painting of what Fort Snelling looked like back at its inception back in the 1800s. I'll stand for questions if there are anything that there needs to be.
Senator Anderson, is there anybody that wants to testify on your resolution?
I have three members here that are in favor of testifying. If you would like to have them come forward, I'd love to have them share.
They feel like they'd like to say something, I'd like to provide that opportunity.
Sure. I'll have the chaplain here, Chaplain Beal, and Mr. Don Van Patten to come forward.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Ken Beal. I happen to be as well that I was an Army chaplain for 25 years, but also currently the chaplain at the historic Fort Snelling Chapel. And I think the heightened attention to the preservation of this club, aside from its early dates of formation and establishment, is the fast approaching on behalf of the state of the 2020 designation of the bicentennial of Fort Snelling. I believe this may well be the first bicentennial celebration for our state, being the age of our state, but that dates back to the oldest structure at Fort Snelling being the Round Tower, and so 1820 is a designated time. So it's important that as there's going to be heightened interest in coming to a bicentennial celebration at Fort Snelling, that that club be in good form to receive both national as well as international guests.
Beal, thank you. Any questions, members? Senator Hand moves Senate File 1828 be recommended to pass. Any discussion? All in favor signify by saying aye.
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 If you're no, the motion prevails. Senator Anderson, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members.
Senator Hayden here? Senator Hayden, Senate File 1275.
Good. Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And members, good to be before you today. I haven't been before rules in a long time. Mr. Chair, members, I have Senate File 1275, the Healthcare Innovation Task Force. Senate File 1275 will allow Minnesota to continue to build on its history of implementing innovative approach to healthcare reform. Senate File 1275 was first heard in Senator Sharon's HHS committee, then in state and local government. It is before you today because the language to appoint members of the legislature to a task force. When creating the task force, we tried to be broad and inclusive. It is a 26-member board with a diverse representation, including care providers, representatives from insurance industry, and consumers. We want the task force to be able to have a robust discussion, and we think this is a good time to have that discussion. Mr. Chair, I do have Maureen O'Connell with Take Action Minnesota that can answer any questions. Otherwise, I stand for questions.
Senator Hayden, I was conferring with counsel. Anything further?
No, sir.
Members, anything further?
Mr. Chairman, why is this bill in rules?
Task force, Senator Pappas.
It's a task force.
With legislative members
with
appointed
legislative
to
members.
It.
All right.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Hand.
thank you, Mr. Chair. Is this going to Finance Committee?
It's already. I believe it's already been there.
Mr. Chair, I'm just wondering because there's an appropriation that is unspecified in the bill. Wouldn't we need to have that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Hand, this next step would be to finance. It went through HHS policy, state and local gov here, and then the finance.
So if it's withdrawn, and it's going to go make the last stop in finance.
Okay.
Senator Hand, okay. Senator Sieben moves Senate File 1275 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Finance. Any discussion? All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Contrary, no. Motion
carries. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Senator Jensen. Senate File 957.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This bill is similar to the one that you heard right before this. We put together a working group to look at insurance fraud in Minnesota under the Commerce Department. And out of that, we created a matrix of issues that we felt were creating the most problems when it comes to insurance fraud. And what came to the top of that list is no-fault insurance. And our statutes for no-fault insurance haven't been updated since the 1970s when it was created. So we felt that a task force on the issues from that matrix would be the best way to try to resolve and find solutions to these issues. Issues like the arbitration process, medical exam, treatment standards and fee schedules, no-fault health provider oversight are the four things that I have listed in the statute, in this bill, that the task force would be taking a look at. We have 19 members that cover enough of the stakeholders, and we are asking this committee to appoint two members from the Senate and two members from the House to also serve on the task force. And I'd be happy to answer questions.
Senator Metzen, is this bill okay?
It's very good. We've been working on this, Mr. Chairman, for what, 2 years, Senator?
Yeah. Actually, Mr. Chair, I would say it's Senator Metzen's fault that we're moving forward on
this. It's my fault that we're here. But it's a very serious. It's projected that every homeowner pays $1,200 to $1,500 more per year for insurance because of fraud. And it's pretty factual. I mean, we've got things that prove that out, so we've got to get to the bottom of it. This is a step in the right direction.
Senator Stump.
thank you, Mr. Chairman. It seems like we have
everybody on here except the ratepayer. I would think that that would be important because all of the people who are on here actually have a vested interest in not exactly lowering the rates.
Yeah, not a bad point.
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Stump, what we did when we listed the members was utilized people that would be responsible for that and felt that the representative and the Senate members that you would be appointing to the task force would have to represent and take into consideration the consumer, because the whole idea of the whole task force is to make sure that we're taking care of the consumer, and this is a consumer protection process. So if you have a suggestion of how we would choose and appoint someone in that capacity, I would be open to listening to that. I just don't know how we would figure out how would we find somebody and who that would be.
Senator Gazelka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think us as legislators absolutely are there to represent the consumer. The whole idea behind this bill or this this group would be to lower the cost of insurance. So this is primarily focused on no-fault insurance. We've actually been trying to work on this for more than 10 years, but it really wasn't until a few years ago, Senator Metzen being a key part of that, that we brought enough people together to actually tackle it. No-fault started in 25 states. That's how many states had no-fault insurance. It's down to 9. And the reason why it's down to 9 is because we have not been able to control the cost. And so a state finally just says, let's just get rid of it totally. I'm of the opinion that we fix no-fault, as is Senator Metzen and Senator Jensen, and this is an attempt to do that. The four areas that Senator Jensen mentioned here were probably the biggest four areas we identified that we couldn't quite get through. And so that's, you know, a lot of these committees are task force I'm typically not in favor of. But this is one that I actually think we can accomplish something. And so, you know, whether we add a citizen on there or not, you know, I'm fine either way, but I think the four legislators will do that job as well.
Senator Metzen, is Commerce Department aware of the fact that they're going to take this out of their existing budget because there's not an appropriation in the bill? And there is actually a cost for the House and the Senate in that remember.
Time for my speech. I've been saying for about 10 years around here, Senator, that every time we ask a department to do something, they need an FTE, 2.5 or 4.5 or 6.8. And this is the 100th time I've given this talk. So if we ask them to do something, do it. Do it. Without more money. That's my speech for the morning or the afternoon, whatever it is. For the decade, yeah, that's right. Yeah, I don't think it's a big deal for the department to tackle this.
Any other discussion? Senator Sieben moves Senate File 957 be recommended to pass. Discussion? All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Contrary, no. The motion prevails.
Thank you. Oh,
Senator Dibble, Senate File 1560.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. What Senate File 1560 seeks to accomplish is to establish a task force on metropolitan governance to study and make recommendations to the legislature. Mr. Chair and members, as you are probably aware, there's been a lot of discussion about the Metropolitan Council and how it operates and how it's formed and you know how things are decided vis-a-vis the metropolitan area, the 7-county metropolitan area. And there have been a number of ideas about perhaps how to better facilitate conversations, decision-making, et cetera. The Metropolitan Council, of course, is responsible for major systems planning as well as service delivery and has taxation authority, able to levy property taxes in the metropolitan area. And there's some feeling in recent years that perhaps while the Metropolitan Council has done many great things to create a lot of cooperation at a regional level and create greater fiscal efficiency and delivering those major services such as sewer and transportation and coordinating land use planning and economic development and housing and those sorts of things, that it might be able to be a little bit better, and that could be brought about through how exactly Metropolitan Council members are selected and appointed, and maybe some protocols around how decisions are made, particularly in the major policy documents that give the Metropolitan Council guidance and that sort of thing. But turned out to be a lot more to take on this session to really nail down exactly what those changes need to be. And important that the region itself agrees with those changes. If we're going to make a major change to the Metropolitan Planning Organization, that's a federally recognized entity for the purpose of various federal authorities that the Metropolitan Council has, the major cities of the metropolitan area need to agree, as well as the municipalities that represent 75% or more of the population. So there needs to be a process, a conversation. That's what this task force would propose to undertake with the various representatives sitting at the table, including legislators, and that's what compels us into the Rules Committee, because, of course, whenever we appoint legislators to one of these entities, Rules has to agree to make that appointment. And so you can see who's designated to sit on the body, representatives of cities, counties, the two large cities, townships, labor, private business, mayors from cities. There's going to be a proposed change on how those mayors are named, a representative of the county's Transit Improvement Board, and the sitting chair of the Met Council. I think there are two amendments that Senator Stephen is going to offer. One is how the mayors are selected rather than the regional council mayors. We do that through the Association of Metropolitan Municipalities. And then Mr. Bodern, I just found out, had some technical changes that we'll need to take a look at as well.
So, Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the A2 amendment. As Senator Dibble explained, this simply changes the appointing authority from the Regional Council of Mayors to the Association of Metropolitan Municipalities for the four metro suburban mayor appointees. And the reason for the change is that the Regional Council of Mayors is an informal organization that operates with no legal structure in AMM or the metro cities, like the League of Minnesota Cities, operates under a more formal structure. Is governed by bylaws and is statutorily recognized. So that's all the A2 amendment does. And then I believe Mr. Bodern has another.
Any discussion on the A2? Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Dibble, do you know how many local communities are in the metropolitan area? I know it's a lot. I don't know the number, but why did you select just simply four representatives, namely mayors from that metropolitan area? The amendment.
From Mr. Chair, Senator Limmer, that was an amendment offered by Senator Scalzi in the last, and she wanted to be sure that there's a distribution of representation, so sufficient number of mayors so that we get hit all parts of the metro. I'll also mention that there are two persons representing cities in the metropolitan area appointed by the AMM, so that would be additive to those two folks as well. I assume those would probably be city council members, but it could be anyone that AMM deems to appoint. It could be regular folks, I guess, but I assume they'd be city council members. I'll look to Patty Nauman to help me. Are there 80? How many metro? Huh? 186 municipalities in the metro area.
Mr. Chair, Senator Dibble, the only thing I'm concerned about is by looking at this amendment, four mayors could be from, let's say, high urban concentration cities and not recognize the smaller communities that might be, well, I'm thinking of an Osseo or a St. Bonifacius, and I fail to see an opportunity to have a wide representation of various communities rather than just four out of the blue, and I don't know how they would be selected or if it would be reflective of the, you know, differing communities. And is there any way we could assure that we would have an equal representation of a variety of communities on this proposal?
Chair, Senator Limmer, we could make that assurance in any form or manner you desire. It would be for the best. We need a variety of perspectives. We could either have Ms. Nauman make oral assurance, or we could put some language in the bill. However you want to handle that.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Limmer.
I'm not prepared to make an amendment to your amendment right now, Senator Dibble, but perhaps we can visit between now and the floor and see what we come up with.
Absolutely.
All right.
Ms. Nauman, anything to add?
Mr. Chair and members, thank you. My name is Patricia Nauman. I'm the Executive Director of the Association of Metropolitan Municipalities. And to Senator Limmer's question, the Metro Cities Board of Directors, when it does make other appointments, for example, to the Transportation Advisory Board, uses processes by which we seek geographic balance and class of city balance. And those are written criteria. I could give you that information as to how we make other appointments if you'd like.
Thank you.
On the A2 amendment, any other discussion? Senator Hamm.
Well, on the amendment, I'll hold off. I want to ask a question about the bill. But.
On the A2, any other discussion? Not all in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Contrary, no. Motion prevails. A2 is adopted. Council has a technical amendment that we'd like to hand out, and then maybe he can walk through it for us. Senator Sieben moves to A3.
So, Mr. Chairman, I think the members have the A3 amendment now. There is one small change that's required, just simply delete lines 2 and 3 of the proposed amendment.
Can Katie just incorporate that?
Yes.
Senator Sieben incorporates deletion of line 1.2 and 1.3 from her A3 amendment.
The change you see on line 1.4 of the amendment will reserve discretion for the House and the Senate to provide per diems under their own rules for members who would serve on the legislative members serving on the task force. The change on line 1.5 provides some definition for what a conflict of interest would be, as that term is used in Subdivision 6 of the bill. And then the change on lines 1.6 to 1.8 is simply necessary to ensure that the money that the task force is authorized to accept would properly be accounted for by depositing the general fund and appropriation to the Met Council for the purposes of the task force.
Any questions on the A3? All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. No, the A3 is adopted. On the bill as amended, Senator Hand.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Senator Dibble, just a couple of questions, I guess. I'm trying to look at this, and is it, in your view with this structure? Would it be a possibility that this commission would meet and recommend that the Met Council be eliminated altogether or severely restricted in its duties? Is that something that is possible under the structure that is contemplated in this bill?
Mr. Chair, Senator Hahn, I don't see any limitation on that possibility. The duties are set forth, well, the purpose is set forth in Subdivision 1 of study make recommendations to the legislature on metropolitan governance and the duties. Study and evaluate models of metropolitan governance to address regional planning, financing, construction, or acquisition and operation of infrastructure and services, including but not limited to transportation, water, and wastewater, parks, trails, recreation facilities, and open space. So I don't think that it's limiting in terms of what might be recommended. You know, I know that it has been discussed in the past when I first got to the legislature that the Metropolitan Council or those functions and duties of the Metropolitan Council be formed on a service-by-service or ad hoc basis of joint, you know, voluntary joint powers or established by statutory joint powers and the like. That might well be an idea that is analyzed by the task force and reported to the legislature.
Senator Hahn.
And thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Dibble. And I guess that was kind of my question. The way the task force is constructed or made up, the membership, it has a number of people selected based on various associations with things that I just am wondering if the bias is sort of inherently in the makeup of the task force would be to probably do the opposite, find greater scope of authority perhaps. And I'm just wondering if the intent is to really look at this, should there not be some way to guarantee or to try to do the best we can to assure that you're going to have opportunity for a real challenge being brought to the current scope of authority, the Met Council, and whether that would be done differently or maybe contemplated done in a different way, as you suggest. And I don't know. I'm just asking the question because I know when we do these task forces, we try to take members in various ways, but I don't know if this is going to provide the opportunity to bring those disparate thoughts maybe to the council itself to make sure that there is a debate about, because I do think you're right. I think there have been a lot of questions raised recently, in the last several years anyway, about the council and what it does and how it does it, but it seems to kind of have a life of its own. It's proven to be very, very difficult to yield to any governance outside itself, and I think that is a problem. So I guess that's why I was asking if it was conceived as a way of reinforcing its current structure and authority, or is it really going to be in a position to take on that bigger question of how this is done, and is it being done in a way that that works not just for its own interest, but for the interest of the whole community, the whole metro area? So maybe you can't answer that question, but I just raise that as a concern.
Mr. Chair, just a quick response. Those are fair questions, and I appreciate them very much. Senator Hahn, the only individual who is directly connected in any professional capacity to the Metropolitan Council is the chair of the Metropolitan Council. I'll just suggest that probably the most energy around taking a fresh look at how the Met Council is conceived, operates, appointed, et cetera, is coming from municipalities. And we have a number of municipal representatives, including township, as well as counties, who are also asking these questions on this entity.
Anything else, members? Senator Pappas moves Senate File 1560 as amended to be recommended to pass. All in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Contrary, no?
No.
The motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Rest.
Six.
this memorial transmits. I bet these guys are waiting for this to come. Stamp these things. Received.
Senator Rest has in front of us Senate File 886. Senator Rest, welcome to the Committee on Rules.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senate File 886 is a resolution which is directed toward the Surface Transportation Board, which has jurisdiction over many of the activities that are conducted by railroads. And it is a memorialization that asks the Surface Transportation Board, in the event that Canadian Pacific and BNSF make an application for a connector project between CP, which runs east-west through my district, and BNSF, which runs north-south, that if they make an application for a connector, right now they simply cross one another, that the Surface Transportation Board ask the railroads to conduct an EIS. And this is anticipating such a request, an application, but we want to make sure that the transportation or the Surface Transportation Board recognizes how important an EIS rather than an EA or an EAW would be to our communities. And I would point out that the major difference, as I understand it, is that in an EIS, you must provide it within the study a number of alternatives and ask for community involvement and comment far beyond that which would be required in an environmental assessment worksheet. It's no more complicated than that, but it is very important to our communities, starting with Plymouth, running east-west or west to east, that this project that happens to be in Crystal be considered a regional project and or have a project that has a regional impact on the western suburbs, and that they recognize that all of the communities, and including Hennepin County, have had passed unanimous resolutions in support of the community's involvement in this project, and in particular through requesting an EIS.
You'll get a lot of money on eBay.
That's it.
Senator Gazelka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Rest, so the way it stands right now, they would likely be required to do an EAW, which is, or you just don't know.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Gazelka, we have no idea what they would require, but to the extent that there would be any requirement, and of course, anytime someone proposes a project like this, or any time where an EA or an EIS is required, it is done with the resources of the requesting body for the project. So this would be done by the railroads, and that's true of any kind of project. The government or the regulatory authority requires it, and then it is done with a firewall between even though the entity is paying for it, there's a firewall in terms of the information and data that is provided from which the requiring authority makes their decisions about whether the project should move forward.
Mr. Chair.
Very good talk.
Thank you. And Senator Rest, one more question, too. you know, over the years we've actually tried to speed up the permitting process because things get drawn out so long that it becomes cost prohibitive. And I'm just wondering, you know, moving, and I'm not saying I'm for or against this. I don't know enough about it, honestly. But moving from the EAW to the EIS, that extends the process quite a bit longer. Any idea how much longer?
Mr. Chairman, it's my understanding, Senator Gazelka, that there is a great span of time, difference in time with regard to the time it takes to accomplish an EIS could be done in, you know, as little as 15 to 18 months. This project, if it is requested, and again, there's been no application yet, and you might ask even before that, so why are you asking for this or are asking them to consider it before they even make the application? And I would say that those of us, and I think there are many of you as well, who have had experience with railroads, that if you wait until tomorrow, you're a day too late. And we want to avoid that and to make sure that if the application is made, that there be a thorough understanding of the implications and the impact on our communities. And in particular, the biggest difference, and they, you know, they could just say okay and not have any kind of environmental assessment, whether it's the EAW or the EIS, that there be the deliberate and thorough involvement of the communities in which this project appears to have the possibility of a major, major disruption in our communities' lives.
Anything else, members? Senator Sieben moves Senate File 886. Any other discussion? Not all in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Contrary, no?
No.
The motion
Thank
prevents.
You very much, Mr. Chairman.
And members of the committee.
Senator Rood. Senator Rood, Senate File 753. Members, we have a subcommittee report from the committee. Subcommittee on Elections. Senator Sieben moves the subcommittee report. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. No, the motion prevails. Senator Rood, welcome to the Rules Committee. Tell us what you're proposing.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Senate File 753 is the Crowing Auditor, Treasurer, and Recorder Appointive Process Authorization. They have also already passed through committee on this. I'm sure you've seen many of these come forward before. Crowing County passed a unanimous resolution by all its county commissioners to do this. In committee before, we had both the auditor, treasurer, and recorder have testified that they do support this. So Crowing County has done their homework on this and really worked hard on this, and they would like to see that this pass. Today I have Tim Houle, who is the county administrator, with me today if there are any questions.
Senator Pappas.
Mr. Chairman, I have a small, minor, non-controversial amendment to give the Rules Committee another chance to do the right thing. That was a joke. I'm giving it up for another 20 years.
Senator Skoy.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Rood and Senator Pappas. I have consistently spoke against these in committee and on the floor. I have less concern about the recorder, but the auditor-treasurer I have always felt should remain an elected position. I am not comfortable having the auditor of the county appointed by the board and then doing the auditing for the county. I know the state auditor oversees, but I just don't think it's a good idea. And so, again, in this committee today, I'm going to not support this. Not going to make a long, drawn-out deal of it either, but I just don't think it's a good direction.
Senator Gazelka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is more for not for Senator Rood, but anybody that may be able to answer it, how many counties now have this option? I know it's kind of been a gradual rollout.
I think our Association of Minnesota Counties representative is here. Good luck.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, good to be here again today. I don't have the raw numbers on here, but I believe something above 70% of Minnesota residents are represented by an appointed county auditor, treasurer, or recorder.
Senator Gazalka?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, but that's not what I asked, how many counties, because that, that's a...
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, I believe that number is 33.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, I move the Senate file 753.
Any other discussion? All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Contrary, no.
No.
Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee.
We have, members, our last agenda item today is the confirmation of three members to the campaign finance board. Why don't we have all three of them come up? And we have a Daniel Rosen, a Carol Flynn, former Senator Flynn, and Christian Sandy. And maybe if you could just tell us a little bit about yourself and what your background has been. And I want to thank you for your willingness to step up and do this work for our state. Mr. Sandy, why don't we start with you?
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Christian Sandy, and I am seeking reconfirmation to the Campaign Finance Board. I was first appointed in October 2013 to fill the remaining term after Andy Lugar, who was my predecessor, was appointed to be United States Attorney for Minnesota. So I was in front of this committee about a year ago, and I went through confirmation in both bodies. My term expired in December, and so the governor reappointed me to a full term, which is why I'm in front of you again. My background is I grew up in Minnesota. I went to Hamline University undergrad and at William Mitchell Law School. I'm an attorney in private practice. I have an office in Minneapolis. I handle mainly class action, antitrust cases, and securities fraud cases. Prior to being on the board, I did election and political law, having served as a treasurer for a number of different campaign committees and political action committees going back to 1996. Since applying to the Campaign Finance Board and being appointed by the governor, I have refrained from handling any election or political matter that could come in front of the board, so that's essentially been the end of my election and political law practice for the time being. And I'm interested in serving on the board because I think that as a former treasurer and election law attorney, my focus has been to kind of bring the practicalities of what it's like to be a part of the regulated community alongside interpreting the laws and focusing on the intent of the laws as they apply to the people of Minnesota rather than just from a broad pedantic standpoint, I guess I might say. And my goal, if you confirm me in the coming years, is to focus on how the board can be able to provide information to the people of Minnesota in a more readily available format to people across Minnesota, particularly by public information statements or web access. We're in the process of going through a significant upgrade of our website as it is. Be curious to hear what you folks think after we roll it out. So it's to conclude my remarks, it's an honor to serve on the board. It's actually been very enjoyable as I've been on it. I've gotten to know a number of you and your colleagues in the legislature. It's also an honor to be counted among other members of the board, former Senator Ed Oliver and prior member, former Senator Deanna Weiner, former Representative Neil Peterson, former Chief Administrative Law Judge George Beck, my colleague Dan Rosen, a prominent Minneapolis attorney, and former Senator Carol Flynn. I have to wonder why am I counted among all these really admirable people. But it is an honor to be among them, and so I hope you will confirm me for a full term.
Mr. Rosen.
Good afternoon, Senators, Mr. Chairman. I'm Daniel Rosen. I'm a lawyer in Minneapolis, where I have a law firm called Parker Rosen. We do what is generally called commercial litigation, a lot of real estate litigation. I was appointed last summer by Governor Dayton to fill one of the spots on the board that is not for a former legislator and that cannot be for a Democrat. If Senators, you understand, there are three that can't be Democrats and three that can't be Republicans. I was appointed to the one of the spots that can't be a Democrat. I'm not. I went to the University of Minnesota Law School. Prior to going to law school, I served in the United States Navy as an officer on a ship, and I've been practicing law for 21 years. When I was asked whether or not I'd be interested in serving on this board, I think the principal reason why I was interested is that a board like this, which is charged with executing laws that are intended to preserve a level political playing field, needs to be careful to ensure that when it's doing that, it's not actually allowing itself to become used by people that are on the playing field to try to tip the field in their direction. If I can accomplish anything while I'm on this board, it would be to hopefully help the board. Not that I see that they've necessarily had deficiencies in this area, but to help the board ensure that it not be used as a tool by political players to tip the field in their direction, but rather be used as an honest broker or an honest adjudicator fair-minded complaints. I've served on the board since last summer, and I ask that you confirm my appointment.
Thank you, Senator Flynn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Carol Flynn, and I'm a former colleague of several of you. I've been retired for some time, and I have to admit I haven't followed you as closely as you might have hoped. I fill the position that's required by statute that it be a former DFL member, and when Senator Weiner chose not to seek reappointment, it seemed important to have a woman on the board, and I am one of the few former senators who's probably not a lobbyist, so that's the other reason I think I'm here. I live downtown now. My district is still well represented, and I don't know that you need to know more about me. I think most of you know me.
Senator Flynn, I believe I was over in the other body when the pie incident took place. Could you tell me what year that was in?
Oh, I can't remember that far back.
Does anybody remember?
99.
Looked it up.
Mr. Chairman. Senator Newman.
I wasn't here then. Could I hear the story?
We'll talk about it.
That was rhetorical.
Senator Metzen probably remembers it, so maybe he can share it with you later.
Privately.
Senator Gazelka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is really to all three of you. The role you play is very, very important. And for us as legislators, both sides of the aisle, I want to know that you look at each case based on its merits only. One of you mentioned a level playing field, which is certainly what I want. I don't want it to be partisan. I don't want to feel like it was partisan. I want them to be uniform, where I have felt that perhaps within the last 6 years, we'll just put a thing on there, that I didn't think it didn't appear to me always necessarily that way. And so I wanted to speak to all three of you as a group and just say it's very, very important what you do, that you do it as well as you can, not being Republican or Democrat, even though we appoint people that way, that you do your best to just look at the facts and render it. And I'm just asking of that to you, that that is what I can expect from you.
Mr. Chair, Senator, I'd be happy to respond. I just attended my second meeting, but it's very clear that we do not act or vote based on party affiliation, that the board is very careful to look at what the staff has investigated and made very broad-minded decisions.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Gazelka, I can make a commitment to you that the attitude that you are seeking is one that I'll bring to the board.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Senator Gazelka, when I was an attorney in private practice, I represented political action committees of both stripes, not just Democrats. I understand the importance of consistency in rulemaking. Moreover, it's important that the board that we listen to one another. For any decision to come out of the board, it requires it to be bipartisan because we have to have four votes for that to happen. What I've found that I guess has made me happy since I've served on the board, I really my first meeting was in November 2013, is that the board members really don't hew to their party lines, that you've got people who focus really on the merits and on policies. The law that was changed last year was Chapter 309 regarding how investigations go forward involve board members, I think, significantly more now in overseeing. It would be a real disappointment to me if we started breaking down on party lines, because I would contrast that with the Federal Elections Commission, which is frankly almost paralyzed now. Because they won't break ranks, and now you have vacant spots that don't get appointed, because the appointing authority doesn't want to put anybody there who's not going to stick strongly with their party. It doesn't make any sense. You can't get anything done. I'll absolutely make a commitment to you and your colleagues I'll tell you the commitment I made to everybody is that I am not going to run for office ever again. My party affiliation is a matter that's well known. It's an identity of who I am. But it's certainly, I'm not looking to gain any points by any vote that I would make on the campaign finance board. It's too important for that.
Thank you.
Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Prior to today, I have not had the pleasure of meeting either Mr. Rosen or former Senator Flynn. But since Mr. Sandy's appointment to the board a couple of years ago, I have had an opportunity to work with him on a number of matters. And although we don't always necessarily agree, I've always found him to be very professional, very open, and our meetings have been fruitful. And so with respect to Mr. Sandy, I would speak to the members and speak in favor of Mr. Sandy and support his confirmation. And, Mr. Chairman, at the appropriate time, I would be more than happy to move Mr. Sandy, his confirmation forward.
Let's adopt the subcommittee report first. The subcommittee report recommends that the appointments be confirmed. Senator Sieben moves the adoption of the subcommittee report. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
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 Contrary, no. Motion prevails. Members, Senator Hand, let me just say, if you could think about while Senator Hand asks a question, if you'd like to move them individually or if you'd like to move the three as a group, I think we can do either one. But Senator Hand.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for your willingness to serve in the capacity. It is a tough, I guess, balance to achieve because we do, as Senator Gazelka talked about, we do want to make sure that this board does deal with issues that come before it in a very fair, even-headed way, and that needs to be understood and perceived by others who are on the field, if you will, that is so. And I wanted to just ask generally, any of you three or all of you may comment, but about a couple of things, and just to get your sense of going forward, how these things might be handled better. One point that has seemed to us has been a couple of occasions recently where some of the investigations have gone on for almost two years before a resolution was brought to the issue, and that has raised some concerns about people who run for election. They may have a violation alleged. It goes through a process. It's finally found out that there was a violation, and so there's an extended period of time from the time the charge is being leveled before it's finally resolved. And because you have elections that intervene, sometimes these are people who take office and serve in the capacity that they're elected to, while there's still a concern sort of hanging over their head. And I guess the question is, why does it take this long? What's your take on going forward? Is this how it should happen? Should there be an effort to make these determinations in a faster manner? I just am curious to know what your... I know you haven't all served on the board for a long time, but I just am going forward how you would address that.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Hahn, I think I can answer your question this way. Coming as a person who's sort of been on the board for in the middle of time, more than Senator Flynn and less than Mr. Sandy, I can tell you a few things based on my experience. Number one, I think all three of us agree that justice delayed is justice denied. That an investigation that we as a board have an obligation to ensure that the board and its staff carry out its investigation as expeditiously as possible. That's number one. Number two is there is a balance that has been created by the law. That you all, I say you as a body, not necessarily individually, have passed that establish our board. Our board here in Minnesota, I think well advisedly, is one that operates on as a small board with a small staff when you compare it to other states. The exchange that you make when you do that is with a small staff and a board that only meets once a month, is that you're going to necessarily have certain extensions in investigations, particularly investigations where there are complications. If you have a staff that reaches a point where they must have board guidance, but it's only 1 week after the previous board meeting, they're paralyzed until they get that guidance 3 weeks later. You have a staff that has to – there are, I think, 3.6 full-time equivalents that are working in enforcement. And by the way, all 3.6 of them, if you can put it in those terms, also have other duties other than enforcement as well. Now, so you're going to naturally have certain delays. I personally would not advocate that you alter the balance. I wouldn't advocate for a larger staff or the things that would possibly allow for these things to move along faster. I mean, these are the balances that we have. But I think those are some of the reasons. But I think what you can have and what I can certainly commit to you and what I believe my colleagues here at the table would commit to you is that every investigation has to be completed in as expeditious a manner as possible. And for those investigations that certainly began before the tenure of any of us on the board, and I'm not really in a position to comment on the history, but going forward, you have a commitment for expeditious investigation and disposition.
Thank you, Mr. Rosen. I appreciate your comment, and I appreciate your approach going forward. I think some of us have been concerned that if there's a way to expedite this process. I was thinking about maybe your argument is for more staff, but now you're suggesting that may not be the right answer. But I do think that is and could be a concern that may raise itself again. I hope not. One other question, again, looking forward, just to get your comments on, there was a case going back to the last election where there was a charge and a determination after the fact, after some lengthy investigation, that there was a coordination issue that occurred, and it took quite a while to resolve itself. And part of that came out at the end that there was a negotiation going on between the campaign committee and the board before the ruling was announced, and to some of us, we had great question about why the board would be engaged in negotiating a settlement while to the rest of the public, to everybody, there was no knowledge of what the decision had been made on the matter itself. And so my question is going forward, is it proper to for the board to enter into this kind of negotiation? And why wouldn't they make a determination on the merits of the case and make a ruling? And I guess if there is going to be negotiation, maybe there should be another way to do that. But it was concerning to some of us that there was this negotiation. I just was curious, from your perspective going forward, is this the proper way to deal with these kinds of issues?
Mr. Chair?
Senator Flynn.
Senator Hahn, with limited experience on the board, I have observed that we're dealing with volunteer treasurers. I'm not speaking to the case that you may be referring to, but what I've observed so far is that negotiations seem to be the right approach. What we really want is for people to meet the law, the requirements of the law, and the filing deadlines and campaign limits that are their responsibility, but we don't see, at least what I've observed so far, that it is inappropriate to negotiate a limited penalty with the understanding that you don't sin again for the next several years, and then it would be removed.
And Mr. Chair?
Sorry.
And I appreciate the comment. I guess the concern in the case that I was referring to is that you had a campaign committee that was found in violation, and they were levied a fairly substantial fine. But the individual campaign committees that coordinated with it were not fined anything at all, which was very unusual. In the history of the board, there's always been a fine and at least the requirement that the amount of money that in question be repaid. None of that was done. It was all subject to this negotiation that occurred. And the fine that was levied was significant. It was $100,000. But after looking at that, I think some could come to the conclusion that if you wanted to deliberately coordinate campaigns going forward, that was a $100,000 cost to do that. I know that's sort of a cynical view of this, but it's that kind of conclusion that could be drawn from the action of the board that I think has raised questions. And again, going forward, I think to Senator Gazelka's point, I think we should have some assurance that as we do these things that they're done openly and fairly and expeditiously so that those kinds of questions would not be raised. And so I know this is a tough issue. I'm not trying to ask you to comment necessarily on past cases, but I think going forward those are concerns that I think the board needs to be aware of.
Okay. Any other comments? Senator Newman, are you prepared to move all three or would you like to move one? How would you like to?
Yeah.
Senator Metzen has advised me it might be a good idea to move all three, and I tend to agree with him after listening to the presentation. So,
let me help then. The council has provided me with some language so we get this correct.
If you wouldn't mind, I'd appreciate it.
On your behalf, Senator Newman moves that the Rules Committee recommend that Daniel Rosen, Carol Flynn, and Christian Sandy be confirmed to the Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board. So any other discussion? All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Contrary, no. The motion prevails.
Thank you, Senator.
Thank you for coming in. The subcommittee. Those of you that are on the subcommittee, committees, we've got one appointment to make. You can just kind of hang
tough.
And that is Bach, Cohen, Fishbach, Han, Metzen, Pappas, and Stump.
Good to remind us all. Supposed to stay. To rock and roll.
Call the Subcommittee on Committees to order Tuesday, April 14th. Members, we have one appointment to the State Advisory Council on Early Childhood Education and Care. Senator Nino, there's not a term on this, so Senator Nino is wishing to continue on there. The previous appointee on behalf of the subcommittee was Senator Torres Ray. She no longer chairs the Education Committee, so Senator Hoffman is interested in serving in her position I think Senator Hoffman has spoke pretty strongly about early childhood issues, so I think that's probably a good selection. So,
I'd move it.
Senator Stumpf moves Senator Hoffman be appointed to this commission on Advisory Council on Early Childhood Education and Care. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Contrary no, the motion prevails. That concludes our business, members. Subcommittee is adjourned.